This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 150. I remember you without a beard. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Michael Fisher. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Star Trek events at San Diego Comic-Con, the real status of Roberto Orci as director of the next film, and our picks for the best engineering set. Then in the feature, we're joined by John Champion and Ken Ray of Mission Log to discuss the launch of TNG and its pilot, Encounter at Farpoint. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Michael. Welcome back to the Ready Room. I'm glad I was finally able to rope you in to co-hosting with me again. I'm chasing Captain Two Phones all the time. You are really hard to catch.
You know, it's difficult, Chris, when you're like me, because you get lost very easily. You get distracted. But fortunately, even though I'm new to these galaxy-class ships, there's always a black panel on a hallway ready to guide me back to the Ready Room. It's lovely to be here with you.
And is there always an ensign standing there to leer at you as you walk away?
Oh, yes, lecherous ensigns everywhere. You got to watch out. Oh, it's great to be back. It's, as always, it's been a while, but it's nice to be here.
Well, we have a great show today, Michael. We're going to be joined by John Champion and Ken Ray from Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast. You know, they are just wrapping up their run through the original series, the animated series, the TOS films, and they're going to be starting into TNG at the end of this month. And they're joining us today to share their thoughts on the shift in Roddenberry's vision between TOS and TNG. And then we're also going to talk a bit about the pilot episode, Encounter at Farpoint.
I was not aware, actually, until recently of the Mission Log podcast and how the format. I was aware of the podcast itself, but not the format. So I didn't know that they had gone sequentially through all of Star Trek up to this point, and now they're transitioning. That's a very exciting transition point. So I'm looking forward to hearing their thoughts on that.
Yeah, and they do a lot of supplementals as well. So they've actually done 113 episodes to get through TOS, TAS, and the films.
Wow.
So wow. It's going to take them it's at least 15 years to get through everything sequentially. And then there will be a new series by then anyway. So they're going to have to go on beyond that.
Fingers crossed. Yes.
Well, Michael, let's go into news here. We have three things to talk about today before we get into the feature. And the first one is San Diego Comic-Con, which is coming up starting on Thursday, July 24th. And CBS has a lot of stuff going on. They have CBS Consumer Products has announced some things happening for Star Trek fans. And then, of course, Star Trek Axanar has something going on as well. What does CBS Consumer Products have lined up for everyone?
You know, I see I see the Comic-Con announcements go up all the time, and I'm always like, yeah, I guess there'll be a little bit of Star Trek stuff there, but I'm not going to go out of my way to go. But looking at everything that CBS Consumer Products has lined up for this thing, I am really mad that I'm not going to be in San Diego on the 24th. It kicks off on Thursday, July 24th. There's a Ships of the Line panel where the designers are showcasing the art, the inspiration of obviously the Ships of the Line, and talk about the 50-year actual world history of fictitious starships, which sounds amazing because I used to have a Ships of the Line calendar on my wall for many years.
Yeah, I keep them around even after the year passes. You know, I love those calendars, but they're not very useful as actual calendars. For me, seeing the days of the month just in one long line, it doesn't help me very much from across the room. But I still buy them anyway because the artwork is so beautiful. I love keeping them around.
amazing. I mean, to me, it's part of the college experience. It's part of that, you know, Star Trek's phase of my life when I was in college. And for Christmas gifts, I would get sent the Ships of the Line calendar every so often. And I just remember it. So many dorm rooms had Ships of the Line calendars that I would, you know, maybe put away if I was having lady company. I don't know. It depended. Usually the, you know, company that was worth having liked them. But at any rate.
So this panel is, of course, not about the calendars per se. It's about the ships.
But
Ships of the Line is where they really showcase a lot of this stuff. And exactly. The lineup is incredible. John Eaves, Andrew Probert, Doug Drexler, John Goodson, Greg Jayne, Mike Okuda.
I've seen Andrew Probert speak actually at a library here near my home in Boston, and he's a wonderful presenter and has a great history. But all of these guys, this is like an all star lineup of ship designers and world creators, and I really think this is going to be quite a treat. There's almost too much awesome to be on one stage if you're a Starship and Starfleet technology appreciator. Not even Starfleet, just Star Trek technology appreciator. So. It's going to be huge. And there's a bonus to attending, as I understand, if you're in the audience.
Yeah, this is cool.
What is it? Because you know this a little better than I do.
Well, everyone knows the official Starships collection has been out for quite a while in the UK, pretty good while in the US. We're just getting it here in Japan. I just got my fifth issue the other day, which is, of course, the USS.
Captain Sulu, USS Excelsior. I see it just got hit by a shockwave there.
It did. It was the, Praxis exploded right there as I was trying to show that to you. And so it shockwave came in.
Energy production facility.
These ships are really cool. They're being done by Eagle Moss. In Japan, they're distributed by DiAgostini. But everyone who attends this panel is going to receive an official Starships collection ship from Eagle Moss.
It's so cool. Chris always makes me jealous when he posts new photos, new Instagram photos of his newest. I have a friend moving in with me soon, and we've agreed to go in together on an Eagle Moss subscription. But that hasn't happened yet, so I don't. You know, I have to settle for my 30-inch Art Asylum Starships that I can't figure out where to put in my apartment. So,
I should mention, this is a good place to mention it actually, that we're doing a reviews promotion right now on Trek FM, where if you go and review our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, you can win some prizes from Trek FM. And some of those prizes are official Starships collection ships from Japan with the magazine in Japanese.
Oh, cool. Yes, that is. That's very cool. Nice, I didn't know that.
Nice, cool collectible. Yeah, just review us in iTunes or on Stitcher. Go to trek.fm/review to let us know what you did. And we'll tell you all about that at the end of the show today. So back into this.
It's important to tell you I'm going to steal that idea. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to steal that idea from my own podcast, but go ahead.
Very good. Are you going to be giving away Android phones, or what are you going to be doing?
I think we'll just stick with Star Trek ships. I think that'll be great.
That works for Pocket Now. All right. So the other thing that's going on that was announced, Michael, is Star Trek Live in Concert. Now, you live in a great city for classical music and for concert performances. I'm sure this is going to be coming to Boston at some point because they're now going on tour. They did these concerts in the Royal Albert Hall in London a while back, and they were a huge success, and they sold out.
I do. Yeah, I certainly hope they're going to be coming around, because now I have not been exposed to much live Star Trek music, but when I have been exposed to it, it's been pre-recorded, but that's okay because it was like a fireworks show that I saw once, and they did the Star Trek IV theme, the Wrath of Khan theme, live over the show, and that in and of itself was just incredible. So to hear this done live by an actual concerto or a symphony would just be incredible. Do you have any more details on that?
Right. Well, have you seen this before? What they do is they actually show, the way they did it in London is that it was back-to-back nights. They did the 2009 film, and then they did Into Darkness. It's a full orchestra, Michael Giacchino conducting, composer of the music himself, and they show the film on the big screen while the orchestra, under his direction, performs the soundtrack as the movie's going on.
Now, that's interesting. It must be a special soundtrack for that film where the music has been removed, but all the other sound effects and the dialogue are preserved. Is that correct?
I would think so, unless they're really, really great at synchronizing, which we know, from watching singers who lip sync, how well that works.
Right. Girl, you know it's true.
Oh, goodness. So that this is going to take place there as well at San Diego Comic-Con on Saturday, July 26th, 8 p.m. at the Embarcadero Marina Park South, with a special appearance by Giacchino. It doesn't say in the press release if he's conducting. I don't know that he always conducts. I think that he did, as I understand it, he did the ones in London, though.
Yeah, it looks like the giveaways aren't going to stop at the Ships of the Line panel. It looks like there's going to be some giveaways for fans who attend, but only if they roll up in cosplay gear. So that's pretty awesome. Yet another reason to break out the old Starfleet duds to enjoy the live Star Trek music. That sounds awesome.
I wonder what those giveaways are. It doesn't say what the
It doesn't say. It's not specific, so. Right? Yeah.
I could guess maybe soundtracks. I'm just guessing here, purely guessing. Soundtracks to the films, yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
But as they always say, cosplay is its own reward.
Is that what they say?
That's what I say. Actually, since the last time I was on the show, Chris, I've been to a local Star Trek convention here in Boston. And I just want to say how cool it is. It's my third one in Boston. It's so fun to dress up, because I always do. I always get my Commander Riker uniform from eighth grade and, you know, I never exhale and it's wonderful. And everyone is so cool, though, out on the streets. They're like, there's no jeering and laughing. Everyone's just really like, oh, wow, is there a Star Trek convention? Wait, where's that happening? Is that happening? Oh, maybe I'll go. It's really cool. Boston's a very friendly place if you're a Star Trek fan. Just FYI, everyone.
Much more friendly than Tokyo, I'm sure.
Probably so.
So last note on this, Colin, who hosts Melodic Treks here on the network, Colin actually has a firsthand account of the Royal Albert Hall performances on Melodic Treks episode 13. So go check that out if you want to find out firsthand from people who were there what it was awesome. Like. One more note here. Now, this is not a CBS Consumer Products thing here, but one more note here. At San Diego Comic-Con, Star Trek Axanar will be premiering Prelude Axanar, and that takes place also on Saturday, July 26th at 9 p.m. It runs till 11. There's a red carpet event at 8 p.m., and then there is also a 90-minute Q&A session with executive producer and creator Alec Peters, who is my co-host on the official Axanar podcast that we're doing here on the network now, as well as Christian Gossett, who is the director, who joins Alec and me on the first episode. Also, Richard Hatch and Gary Graham will be there for the Q&A. And this takes place at the United Artists Horton Plaza 8 Movie Theater in the Gaslamp District in San Diego. And there will be 150 tickets made available free to the public. That's on a first-come, first-served basis. Those who contributed to the project on Kickstarter, those supporters, the event is primarily for them for the premiere, but there are 150 tickets available for the general public. But again, it is first-come, first-served.
So what's that mean, Chris? You got to camp out probably well in advance of the event to get in the door, or what, like... Do you know any details on that?
I don't know what the anticipated, line time, is that a word? Is that what they call it in
sure,
the world
probably.
Of smartphones?
Line time.
Where you camp out
yeah.
for line time?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I would just say that if you want to see the premiere, which you really should, because it is incredible. Prelude Axanar looks just amazing. You really get there does. As soon as you can and yeah. get there well ahead of the 8 p.m. red carpet and get your tickets.
I know it's redundant to say, and I don't want to sound like a shill, but I got to tell you, I have been excited about Axanar since I first saw the first inklings of it, and I am really, really jazzed to see this. Of course, I won't be in San Diego to see it, but if you are near there, you should maybe think about camping out, because that sounds like I would do it. If I were anywhere near San Diego, that is exactly what I would do.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. So that's what's happening at San Diego Comic-Con. And now let's go into the next story here, Michael. This is a poll that was on StarTrek.com. We like to talk about these from time to time. And I know how you are with your sets and your gadgets and everything. And since I knew you were co-hosting, I pulled this one out. The poll asked, which ship has the best engineering set? They had more than 26,000 votes. What were the results?
You cherry picked a wonderful one. The results, though, may surprise you. They surprised me, and not necessarily the first place. So in first place, with 28% of the vote, the best engineering set in all of Star Trek, the USS Enterprise 1701E from First Contact onward. And, I mean, Chris, how do you feel about that? Before we talk about the rest of the result, how do you feel about that winner there?
I like that set. It looks great, but I don't know. We don't see enough of it compared to the others, I think, for me to put it at the top of the list.
That's true, but I see why people would vote for it, because I liked it a lot and every time it made an appearance. But it, to me, I think it strikes the best balance between the sort of JJ era scale at all costs approach. You know, just like, let's see how mammoth this is, and the established design language that we see from the Star Trek world with the warp core and everything like that. I guess I can understand why that. I take the Enterprise E engine room seriously, so I understand why it was voted that way. Yeah. Next up in second place with 26% of the vote, for some reason, Voyager.
Okay, well, you say for some reason. This is interesting to me, because I think that when we talk about 24th century Star Trek, Voyager is the only ship that we really get to see on screen on a consistent basis where it feels like they built an engineering area that makes sense as the propulsion center of this starship.
Like, how do you, in what sense? I, you know, my initial reaction was revulsion, because I just see it as too clean and too nice. But I guess
I can see that part. Yeah.
But if it's state of the art 24th century technology, you know, with this brand new Intrepid class ship, I get it. And I always like the swirl chamber, that intermix chamber there. So, well, I think
for me, Voyager and the Enterprise E set have something in common. And when I say that it makes sense that it would be the propulsion center, is that it's large. You've got multiple levels. The warp core keeps going up and up and up, and there, you know, you have to go up and down. And, and we really didn't see that. Like, okay, so the next one on the list with 24% is the Enterprise D. Now, the Enterprise D in Encounter at Farpoint, which we're going to talk about today in the feature, you actually do get a feeling that this is a little bit larger. Like, you see there's an elevator where they, there's a lift where they come in.
Good use. Yeah.
But as TNG goes on, the engineering section always feels like it's like a closet somewhere. Because sort of the concept was that this ship is so advanced that it flies itself. So why would you need a huge engine room? The engineering set for the Enterprise D for me would probably be last on the list. I don't think that it makes sense as an engineering set. Now, when you get to the films, there are moments where, like, you see Geordi doing his barrel roll. Under the blast doors or something. But so often in TNG, all we see is that little closet area where they've got the warp core at the end, which seems way too small for that starship. And then you've got, like, the little table in the middle where they like to meet and
the pool table. I love that. You're talking about all the things I love about the Enterprise.
But does it make sense as an engineering set for a starship?
It does if they shoot it right. I think an Encounter at Farpoint, where you have these kind of cool handheld camera angles, and like you're getting up close to the warp core and you're focusing on the stuff, or in later episodes in the first season when Worf blows away that other Klingon and he falls through all the glass down the thing, you know, that's when you see the scale of the set, or when it's shot well. I think later on, as they start to kind of shoot the set differently, it does start to take on that closet-like quality. And I agree with you. In that sense, the Voyager set really trumps it in terms of, you know, volume and stuff. But I always like the look of the Enterprise D's warp core, as, you know, it looks like it's made of cast iron, like some kind of, potbelly stove, which I think for some reason communicates a lot of power to me. I don't know why.
That's true. Yeah, I get that.
But you want to talk about the next one on the list? Because I feel like maybe this one got a little bit of short shrift.
Well, I think so. 8%, the NX-01. I would put the NX-01 up in the top three for sure, because now it's a different kind of engine room. But the NX-01 engineering set has a couple of great features. First of all, it feels like an actual real propulsion system that we would build on a ship. It's not that clean, futuristic lava lamp warp core. Right. The other thing is that it's a callback. It serves as a bridge to the engineering set that we see in the motion picture with the long, stretched out components.
Absolutely, it does. And it recalls also that kind of submarine-like feel that Enterprise went for so many times. I would have found it a little bit more realistic if the warp core had been so new and experimental that they'd thrown it in another compartment, like they do in real submarines, where the reactor compartment, you can't go into it while the reactor's operating. But, you know, having Trip at the console there right next to the lights and stuff, and then you know, the doors on hinges, because you get the impression the doors have to do a little bit more in this space. They have to hold back some awesome power if something goes wrong. I agree. I think that 8% is a little weak for the old NX01 there.
I think so.
And then 7% of the vote went to the – should we just say that the last two entries are tied, right?
They are tied, yeah, 7%.
1701 Alpha and 1701 Original. Now, here's where I think the poll is all wrong, Chris. Because think about 1701A. We saw the engine room in Star Trek V for, I think, about 6 seconds, and you didn't see any part of it. You just saw a wall behind Scotty. And in 6, it's basically a redressed Enterprise-D. So, and the original 1701 that they're referencing is obviously the one from the TV show with the, you know, chain link fence and the big tunnels. So, but why is the refit 1701 not on here? I think that's the certainly my favorite engine room in the whole thing.
This is a problem that I have with StarTrek.com's polls in general, is that they give you choices and you're locked into those. There's no write-in vote.
No write-in.
And it's sometimes it works fine, but often when you see polls that they do about characters, you're scratching your head because the results are so skewed, because there are 4 characters who should have been on there that weren't, and 2 characters that shouldn't have been on there that were.
Right.
And so what do you do? Yeah, the refit is the one, because if I think about winter moments where we saw engineering more, well, the Wrath of Khan, when Spock goes in to stick his hand down inside to get the mains back online. I mean, that's the moment, and that's the refit, and it's not even on the poll.
And exactly. And it is the it is where we first see the drop down isolation door from the overhead in Star Trek, which is, you know, hugely important for how much we see it later on, and obviously for Peter Press. So, and it is also where we first see that the swirl gas chamber of the intermix chamber, which I first time I saw that in the motion picture, I was so amped. I thought, that's so cool. And, you know, you get a sort of sense of the design of the Enterprise with that forced perspective set of the horizontal intermix shaft going aft and the branch ups going to the nacelles. You can place the set within the ship. I always thought that was so important. And it's a shame that the pole is positioned thus, but
I just
interesting.
Why not add one more option and put that one in there?
That's absolutely, you know, yeah. Well,
oh well.
In any case,
there we go.
Oh well, that's so, how we would do a poll.
So, but if that were on the poll, I mean, where would it place for you? What would be your ranking for the 1701 refit?
That it would be so high. The only thing that could kick it out would be the Enterprise E for me, but it wouldn't. The motion picture and Wrath of Khan engine room is it for me. That's as good as it gets when it comes to combining scale with a sense of place within the ship and Starfleet technology that looks believably futuristic, with the exception of that pedestal, which just looks like a diner stool that was put there for no reason for me.
So for me, it would be, it's tough for me to choose between Voyager and the Enterprise E as a set. So I have to discount how much of it we got to see, because the Enterprise E engine room, like in First Contact, when they're working in there and they climb up to go find where the Borg, it's really beautiful. And then the NX-01. So those are my 3.
It's good. It's a good selection. The next poll should be best warp core ejection sequences. So I would have some yes, more opinions on that.
How about best aborted warp core ejection sequences? All the times that we were threatening to eject the warp core but didn't. Or best threats to ram the ship into another ship. But
these are all polls I would vote in. Yeah. Why aren't we doing this? Why don't we just have a StarTrekPoll.net. Let's buy it.
let's do it. All right. Well, let's go into the last thing here. This is a story that I talked about on Hyper Channel recently, which is our daily news show. But I wanted to get your thoughts on it, Michael, because we tend to talk about the films and the Abrams Burst films when you're on here a little bit. You know, since May, we've all been operating under this assumption that Roberto Orci is the director of the next Star Trek film. I certainly took it as being an official thing. It seemed that way.
It did.
Well, he was recently talking to Collider, and he said that he is not officially involved in the project, and the studio has to read the script and approve the script first. And what he said was, well, I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch. The studio has yet to even read the script, so I can't even think anything about the future. If I'm lucky enough that Paramount loves the script and that we go forward, it'll be because I have loved Star Trek for so long and the idea of having seen one of the best guys in the business direct two of them already. So,
right.
What do you think about? Do you think this is... I think it's just him trying to keep his own expectations in check. And as he says, not count my chickens before they hatch. I don't actually think that there is anything up in the air. I think he is the director. But what do you think?
Well, when I first read the story, to me, it read like an actual change in circumstances. Because like you, I was, you know, lulled in by all the headlines earlier that said he's confirmed he's the guy. He's the guy who's going to direct it. I even had a conversation at a party regarding that where I was in a heated disagreement with someone who was like, it's going to be miserable. I'm like, nah, it's probably not going to be miserable. And so now we have this kind of – it reads like damage control to me a little bit. Like something happened. It became less certain and now they're – but I don't know. I think they're both flimsy stories. This one – and the initial announcement are both – they both have enough play in them to where I doubt I could reasonably doubt either one of them. So I don't know what to believe really, you know.
So you think that someone has seen the script and is like, really? I don't know about that. And now he's worried about it?
Well, there's just a lot of variables here because we have, you know, the writers who – I believe were recently interviewed on.
Yeah, they were on Mike commentary. And Max had them on Commentary Trek Stars, J.D. Yeah. Kane and Patrick McKay. Yeah,
and I listened to that one. Those guys sound great, and I'm not gainsaying them at all. But you know, we know that they are relatively new writers, right? Not as a whole, but they've written a lot
of scripts, but never had anything produced.
Yeah, that's what I. Okay, thank you. And so we have that element already with this franchise that is very valuable. And I don't think it's completely out of the question that somebody looked at the situation and Orci would be a first-time director if he got this gig, right?
Yeah, it would be his first time in the director's chair, yeah, of anything.
Right, so I can imagine some conservative element saying, you know, hey, listen, do we want to mate a first-time director with writers who, you know, who are not veterans in this field? You know, I don't know. Not in this field, in this, you know what I mean, in Star Trek sector, so. I don't know.
In the Star Trek sector. They were the only ship in the quadrant.
That's right. Yeah. Do we want to, you know, do we want a harem in the captain's chair? But, you know, I don't know.
I don't know. I took it differently. I took it because I'm the kind of person who I have stuff going on all the time. I have projects in the work. I'm working on agreements with people on things. And I just don't talk about things until they're done. Because you never know what might not happen. And
that's
so,
true.
You know, I don't want to say this is coming up, even though if I'm like 99.9% sure that it's going to happen, I still don't talk about it till it's done and then I'll mention it. And so I took it as maybe Orci being a little bit more in that vein that he really wants to do this, but he doesn't want to get worked up too much about it until it's all finalized. And so it's sort of just tempering his own expectations.
That makes a lot of sense. And I get that. That was some of the best business advice my father ever gave me. So speaking of the business, I was when I brought home my first check for an acting gig that was substantial. And I was excitedly telling my father all about it on the phone. And he was like, all right, well, you know, that is great. But, you know, wait until you cash the check. to celebrate. It's like, you know,
exactly.
It's good advice, Dad. So, yeah.
All right. Well,
I hope that's the case. I mean, I think it would, I would not be either excited or disappointed to find out either way. Chris, do you have a dog in this hunt? Do you really want to see Orci in the center seat for this one? Or
I don't know. I mean, I'm not so gung-ho like it has to be Orci, but I actually think that Orci and Payne and McKay together are going to give us a better movie than the last two that we got, because I think Orci really knows Star Trek and loves Star Trek in a way that J.J. Abrams doesn't. And I think if he is calling all the shots, that we will get something that we think is more Star Trek than the last two films.
I certainly hope you're right. No matter who ends up in the center seat, I hope you're right about that.
So if you want to listen to the interview that we just mentioned on Commentary Trek Stars, that's episode 87. It's a little over an hour. And
it's awesome.
It's McKay and Payne. As far as I know, it was the first and maybe still the only podcast, but at the time anyway, the first podcast that they had done talking about Star Trek. So go tune into that.
It's so much fun too. I really enjoyed listening to that one. I remember seeing him on Twitter feed like, whoa, they got the writers? I'm going to listen to this one real quick. And then it was awesome. So yeah, go do it.
All right. Well, that's all we have in news today, Michael. Before John and Ken join us to talk about TNG and Encounter at Farpoint, we would like to tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, and that's Audible.com. They're the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere online. They have over 150,000 titles waiting for you. Star Trek books, new releases, bestsellers, classics, pretty much anything you can think of. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. And to do that, you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. And we like to recommend a book for you every week to pick up as your free book, usually a Star Trek book. Michael, I understand you have something to recommend today.
I do. I love this. The Star Trek universe is so big that like everything I find, it always recalls a period of my life that came before. And this one is represented by Star Trek New Frontier. Books 1 through 4 are all in the same kind of bundle here. It's written by Peter David and John J. Ordover, narrated by Joe Morton. And this is the adventures of Captain Calhoun and his crew, including some old friends from Next Generation, as I recall. I read this in junior high. It has been a long time. I am really looking forward to revisiting it now, actually. The series is set aboard a newly refit Ambassador-class starship called Excalibur. And the adventures are great. And anytime you can spend any time aboard an Ambassador-class starship, you should definitely do it, especially if your captain has violet eyes. Not violent ones, violet.
And especially if Leffler is a member of the crew, as she is in this
Absolutely.
Story. So,
making new rules all the time.
That's right. Leffler's laws live on. So, yeah, go check this out. I remember reading this myself when it was originally released as four rather short, what we would think of as novellas these days. Not that novellas weren't around then, but in terms of Star Trek, you weren't really getting novellas, you were getting novels. But now we get lots of novellas with Star Trek-y novellas, and they were kind of like that. And they released them in four parts. And I actually remember picking them up in the grocery store, of all places.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yes, in the little novel section.
Yeah,
Yep. And, oh, that was a magical summer.
It was, right. But now you can catch it in audio format, again, narrated by Joe Morton. And you can get it absolutely free by going to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Sign up for the trial. Pick Star Trek New Frontiers, books 1 through 4, which are all together in one, or anything else you want. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose. You get to keep that book. But if you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. And if you're getting them from another source, you really need to get them from Audible. That's where I've been getting mine for the past 14 years. So as you can imagine, I have hundreds of audiobooks in my library right now. But I love the service that much. I'm still with them, and I have no plans to stop anytime soon. So go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and try it out for yourself. And we really thank Audible for their support of The Ready Room and the network. Few creators get a second chance to explore their original vision, but Gene Roddenberry got such a chance with The Next Generation 21 years after the original Star Trek first aired. TNG's pilot, Encounter at Farpoint, is a restatement of Gene's utopian ideas, which are challenged by Q, but of course these ideas evolved a bit over the course of two decades. Today we're going to talk about The Next Generation and its pilot. And to help us do that, we're joined by another crew that is about to embark upon a mission to explore TNG, John Champion and Ken Ray of Mission Log. John and Ken, welcome to the Ready Room.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And John, before we get going here, I just wanted to say congratulations to you on your land purchase this week.
Oh, you saw that. Yeah,
I did.
Yeah, it was very exciting.
land is not easy to come by in Frontier Land at right. Disneyland. If you're a Diz nerd like me, then they have a new promotion going on with interactive characters, and you can actually earn credit in Frontierland, and you can become a landowner. It's very exciting. So we actually opened the Prosperity Ranch. We wanted to give it a little bit of a Star Trek hint to it there. So
very good. Thank you. DVD Geeks is going to be recording from the ranch moving forward.
Oh yeah, we'll build a studio there. Clearly, yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump into this here, and the we're going to talk about Encounter at Farpoint as an episode today, but we're also going to talk about the Next Generation and this bridge from TOS to TNG, which of course is separated by two decades, but we did have the films in between. And Ken and John, you guys just published, right before we recorded this, you published Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, your final show about the film. So Ken, how are you feeling about heading into TNG here?
Well, I'll be honest. I had not lived, or had not before we started doing a Mission Log. I had not lived with the original series cast nearly as much as I have with Next Gen. And so when we started this, the whole time I was thinking, I can't wait to get to Next Gen. I can't wait to get to Next Gen. And then when we got to the end of Star Trek VI, I cried. Because I have now seen every bit of this, and I've seen every bit of this more times than I can even, accurately count at this point. So I go, both with a little bit of excitement, because this, for all intents and purposes, is my Star Trek series. The Next Gen is my Star Trek series. But I already miss the original series crew.
How about you, John?
Yeah, I'll second that. I mean, well, first of all, speaking of bridges, I definitely prefer the TOS bridge to the TNG bridge. There's a kind of wide-eyed excitement about the original series, and then when you get to see that cast mature into the people that they become, and you get to sit there and connect the dots going backwards through the stories that they had. It's really kind of remarkable what they were able to accomplish. And people ask all the time, well, what is that special element that makes Star Trek Star Trek? And it's so hard to put your finger on that, because they were sort of blessed with this great combination of the right cast playing the right characters, some terrific writers, and it seems like even the things that were working against them at some point were working for them as well. Things like being canceled, things like having budgets cut, things like turnovers in the regimes that produced these movies. All of these things they were able to rally around and come out with more and better Star Trek. So there's an attachment that I have to this cast and to the work that they produced, that, like Ken, I find it really hard to leave behind. I'm excited to get into the storytelling of Next Gen. But it was bittersweet finishing it the way that we did.
Michael, what about you? This will be semi new to listeners, because you typically come on to talk Deep Space Nine or Enterprise with us. But I know you love TNG. You've written articles about pads and communicators and all sorts of things here.
Oh, very much so.
How did you feel about TNG as the new Star Trek?
I share Ken's feelings on this. I mean, yes, DS9 I value in a very different way, and Voyager and Enterprise and so on. But I grew up with Next Gen, so I mean my sentimental attachment is with the Enterprise D. In fact, I was watching Next Generation before I saw the original series. So, this is the ship that I am familiar with, the people that I was most invested in as a youth. And I actually remember when I first saw Encounter at Farpoint, because when I was younger, Next Gen was such a hot property that several channels ran it in syndication, alongside reruns alongside the new episodes. And we were watching one particular channel that aired it every night at 7 p.m. And then one night, I guess we got up to the most recent one, or they decided to reset the clock. And all of a sudden, it's 7 o'clock, and there's no teaser. There's no anything. There's just this strange intro sequence with planets. But it's the same music, so we know we're watching the same show. And we realized, my siblings and I, at about age 9 or 10 or something, that we were seeing the first one, the first Next Gen. And I mean, it was... we're going to talk about the journey it was, but boy, what a shock and what a treat to see the origin story of everyone that we had come to adore. So, I'm happy we get to talk about it, because it's TNG to me is very special, and Encounter at Farpoint is where it all begins, for better or for worse.
It's something when you watch. We watched all the films this past week, and we did a Ready Room that was a TNG film face-off. So, before watching Encounter Farpoint again for the 10 millionth time to prepare for this show, I had just seen Nemesis and seen Picard walking down the corridor after the ridiculous scene with before, but I won't go into that. But seeing that and then watching Encounter at Farpoint and seeing that first scene zooming in of Picard coming out of the shadows and just thinking that's the scene where it started, and then everything that grew out of that. Not only everything for TNG, but DS9, Voyager, and then even Enterprise, everything that grew out of this moment of relaunching Star Trek is pretty incredible.
Absolutely. And it's actually funny you bring up Nemesis, because I was just thinking about that today as I was rewatching Encounter at Farpoint, which I did just before we came on the air. And that scene in the holodeck when Riker and Data first meet has a whole lot of poignancy now, knowing that in-universe and in the real world, so much time has gone by between the beginning of the Next Generation story and the sort of end of it that, it was so long ago that Riker can't remember the tune in Nemesis. And that just gives you a sense of the scope of this family's journey together. And it actually stopped me for a second. I was like, oh, my God, this is the scene. You can't remember the thing. Oh, God. I know where you're coming from.
And Data's thinking, I remember, well, this would be back to Insurrection, but I remember you without a beard, I think.
Smooth as an android's bottom.
Well, let's talk about the tone. So, Ken and John, on Mission Log, or the basis of your show is about exploring Gene Roddenberry's ideas behind Star Trek and the meaning behind Star Trek. And as we all do, as we get older, our views of the world change, our ideals change, and you can see that a bit with the Next Generation. With TOS being so fresh in your minds right now, let's talk a little bit about how TNG differs in setting a tone for Star Trek and for the messages that Gene Roddenberry wanted to explore and to send in the series.
Well, I'll preface this bit by saying that, I think Roddenberry has been very insightful to say that TOS was his dad in his early to mid 40s, a guy who was a cop and a pilot and had all this wealth of experience behind him. TNG was a show that was made by his dad in his 60s. And having gone through the wave that was Star Trek, and I think one of the things that had to have influenced that is the time to have a little reflection on what they had created. You know, very often in reviewing and watching TOS, Ken and I sit there and we say, wow, they certainly did the best they could, but they were also inventing this from week to week. Some stories are great, some stories are not. And they often forget from week to week where they've been and what they've done.
Right.
Now you have the luxury of not only creating a show from scratch and being able to build in the contingencies for all these problems that may have come in doing a TV show the first time around, but you also have Gene Roddenberry, who for the better part of 20 years has been going around and doing the lecture circuit and going to conventions and talking to fans and being able to look at his own creation from a bit of distance and really thinking about it as a kind of philosophy. And I don't think that it's you know, I think we typically try to downplay the idea of Star Trek being super important. It is important to a lot of people. In the greater scheme of things, it's a piece of science fiction literature, and it's designed to be provocative, and as he always said, it's there to entertain, and if they drop a heavy idea in there every now and then that's great. But, you know, for the better part of that two decades, being able to talk to fans and look back on what he had done, it had to have given him incredible insight on how then to approach the next generation, for better or for worse. You know, there might be too many things, particularly in those first seasons, that are either a little too conservatively played or maybe to the detriment of drama when you don't allow the characters to sort of break out of the molds that that maybe he had insisted on from the beginning.
I would say one of the things that's been most fascinating to me is that he's starting over in a way. I mean, it's the same universe, obviously. I mean, it's Enterprise 1701D. Bones is actually there for all of a minute, I think. There's a Klingon on board, and that Klingon has some of the tradition, I guess, or history that wasn't really part of the original series. It didn't actually show up until about Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, I think we decided. But otherwise, he's starting over. I mean, when we get to the Mantrap, was it? Was that the second pilot? Or the second first run?
Oh, yeah.
It was the first episode aired.
First run.
Yeah. But it wasn't really the second pilot produced. Yeah, that was Where No Man Has Gone Before.
When we get there, though, they're a crew that's been working together for a while. I mean, the viewer is just thrown in the middle on this. And I don't know if that's a difference between TV then and TV in the 80s, or if there was a concern that, you know, people would think they had missed something if we just started with all of this. But we got a new captain. We've got a relatively new ship. We've got a new first officer. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of new, which is an interesting way to tell the story. This is not, I mean, yeah, they're in an existing universe. But, you know, if you've never watched Star Trek before, okay, here's your beginning. Here's where we're going to start. And they do that in a way that, like I say, I don't know if it's just a difference in TV. I mean, I don't know. I never watched Bonanza regularly, so I don't know if there was like a big origin story or if we just learned it as we went. We're getting origin story all over the place. As you said a moment ago, we're getting origin story all over the place, and it's actually really neat to not to just sort of be thrust into the middle of it, but actually to get to grow it up. Will that get tiring? It's been a long time since I watched it straight through, so I don't know. Check back in a few weeks, and I'll let you know.
Well, as you guys mentioned on the mission log dealing with Star Trek V, you know, maybe they're just used to it at this point. I mean, we started every movie with basically a new Enterprise, or the Enterprise is beat up, and it's just been rebuilt, and we have new people, new, you know, it's just this constant restart loop. It's like, well, all right, now that we're moving from, you know, four to the next gen, yeah, we'll just we'll go ahead and, you know, show everybody the origin point, and that'll be fun. But I agree with you. There's some powerful storytelling opportunities that come up when you do that. And I hadn't thought for a while, but that is how it is done in the original series. They just drop you right into the middle of this mission. It's like, you know, all these people know each other, right? This is just, you know, welcome aboard. You're seeing one of their regular weeks. And maybe it's more conventional to start with introductions to everyone, but I liked how Encounter at Farpoint did most of it, because the crew is scattered. You know, we get to see them in different environments. In some cases, we get to see them meeting each other. And that provides some interesting opportunities to, among other things, make Captain Picard look like the world's least appealing captain ever.
I do think that goes back to kind of the difference in production. You know, in 1966, making a TV show that you don't know will be played in order. Very often it's not, particularly at that time. They jump all around in production schedule versus air date schedule. And the whole plan is to get to that magic number of episodes so you can break it up and sell it in syndication. And at that point, it doesn't matter. So if you're in the middle of the action, great, you're in the middle of the action. Next Gen, they knew that they were selling this as a syndicated show from the beginning. And I think they also probably knew that there would be a lot of attention on it. There'd be a lot of Star Trek fans watching it from the beginning, no matter what. So you could actually begin with the premise that here are character arcs, here are plot lines that will play out over time. You know, fast forward another 20 years and modern TV production, as of the recording of this show, shows are planned out from the very beginning to the very end. You know, I read an interview not long ago with Matt Weiner from the creator of Mad Men, saying that he had come up with the end of that show years ago. He's told people about it and they hate it, but he's going to stick by his guns and that will be the end of his show. So, you know, Next Gen kind of falls in the middle there. You have the luxury of being able to tell long form character arcs, long form, if not stories, at least plot points that can play out and show up every now and then. So they have a bit of that freedom to be able to introduce a character and just let that sit with the audience for a little bit, rather than having to dump you into action right away. I think both are valid. I think both are valid ways to make a show, and certainly it plays out very well in the original series, the way that they did it. But yeah, it totally changes the feel when you get into Next Gen.
And this was a particularly unusual approach at the time when they did it with The Next Generation. A show like this going into syndication from the very beginning was not something you would normally see.
But it was an idea that Paramount had flirted with forever, according to Star Trek Phase 2 lore, right? Which wasn't lore, I guess.
But. Although Paramount, even with Phase 2, was they were really wanting to start that network, even
right,
going back
was,
into the 70s, yeah.
But that was going to be a syndication thing. I mean, they weren't going to go out and do O&Os. They were going to, I mean, basically they're going to build a network the way Fox ended up building a network, 8 years later.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting little... aside that when they tried to reboot Star Trek for television the first time, they basically did the same thing that they tried to do the second time, or that they actually succeeded in doing the second time, I guess.
Before we get too far away from the discussion of the ship that we had a moment ago, at the beginning, John, you mentioned that you prefer the TOS bridge to the TNG bridge, and we are talking about setting the tone and impressions of this new Star Trek right now. So talk a little bit more about that, these two bridges. When you saw this 1701D bridge for the first time, especially an encounter at Farpoint where it feels even more spacious than it does later on.
Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of empty room on that bridge, doesn't it? It's kind of weird, the placement of the chairs and the color of the carpet and all of that. I do like visions of the future. It's fascinating that every generation, you get visions of the future that definitely speak to that generation. If you look at the, you know, Jules Verne, H.G. Wells look at the future versus the, 1930s, say, World's Fair look at the future. In the 60s, Star Trek had its, also inspired by the 1964 World's Fair, but tried to be utilitarian as well. By the time you get to the mid-80s, something to me that is very comfortable but very stale about that. I really like the look and feel of the movie sets, the movie bridges, the original series movie bridges.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But there's something about the design scheme of Next Gen that it just never quite sat well with me, whether it was the Enterprise or the actual set layout and design. I actually love the accoutograms. I love the computer displays. I think they make sense. They look real. There's something about them that's really cool that is still futuristic to this day.
Right.
But yeah, wow. I understand the look they were going for. They assumed that this was a longer mission. They assumed that there would be a wider variety of people on board, families, etc. It had to accommodate for comfort as well as function. But I don't know. We got a long way ahead of us on mission log, and I don't know at what point I will actually become comfortable with the look and feel of the Next Gen bridge.
I like the wood. I like the wood going around the rail in the back, honestly. I mean, that
like
to me
it?
Was
yeah.
like a...
Yeah.
I do. And there I mean, there is something about... I mean, this is where these people live and work, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is... I mean, this is... I think there's something to be said for creature comforts, which we never saw any of in the original series. Even the rec room in the original series was just like a horrible, boring 1960s gym, right? With like a medicine ball. It's like, oh, you want to go relax?
Especially in the motion
picture.
Let's
wrestle.
It is like a gymnasium.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, motion picture actually was sort of like a TWA waiting room. It seemed like, like the Admiral's Club of some 1970s airline. It seems.
You know, it's a good point. I think that may be part of the thought process, though, is that in the 24th century, this space exploration thing is so routine for these people that this is their office, that is where they work, and it's their home. So let's just make it feel comfortable. Let's make it feel like a place where people actually live instead of this ship where you really feel like you're on a submarine, which is still how the original Enterprise felt a bit more. It's not like the NX-01, of course, but compared to the 1701D, it is.
Yeah, yeah. The difficulty of that is that, the future of the 1960s looks like the 1960s. The future of the 1980s looks like the 1980s. And Enterprise, I think, holds up very well, at least now, in 2014, looking back at Enterprise. It holds up really well because there's something about its version of futurism that is very tangible.
Yeah.
And you can look at those sets and go, if I look at the ISS right now and I extrapolate, that's how that future could look. But in another 10 years, maybe that will look very dated.
Yeah, too. Enterprise is already starting to look, you know, they're when they shoot the set at angles that you can see those, the flat screen displays on the walls that were so hot in 2001. It was like, that's very future. And I'm like, wow, the viewing angles on that are really sucky. I hope this is not the future.
Well, you know, part of that also has to do, I think, with production technique. You know, it's really interesting to look at Next Gen, look at the way the first few seasons are lit and shot. And Chris, you know, going back to what you were saying about in the pilot and Farpoint, things on that bridge look very distant and very open. You look at the later episodes, and particularly in the first movies, it has a very different look and feel. Yeah. Look at Star Trek Continues. Okay, Star Trek Continues, they did this rebuild of the original series bridge, and it looks more futuristic than that same bridge was shot in 1966. You've replaced those screens with panels, you know, like you were just saying, with, digital panels. The lighting, the filming techniques are very different. So I kind of look at that and go, oh, wow, maybe that 1966 bridge is really on to something, you know?
You talked about World's Fairs a little bit and how it foretold like the technologies to come. One thing that I do remember with this episode coming out in 87 is I remember going to the 1984 World's Fair in New Orleans, and one of the big things were the touch panels and this touch interface.
And I was there too. I wonder if we saw each other.
Maybe. Well, John, you know, I don't know if Ken knows this. I think Michael does, that you and I lived down the street from each other all through high school and never met. And now you live in Los Angeles and I live in Tokyo.
Getting closer every minute, yes.
Well, let's talk about characters a bit before we get into the story and our first meeting of Picard and Riker and Data and Troy and everyone on the ship and Wesley, as well as sort of representing Gene Roddenberry here. Ken, what were your impressions of these characters?
I've got to defend Wesley, and I am really surprised, and I'll probably get as sick of him as everybody else does, or as everybody else did. I never really got into that, honestly. I never hated Wesley the way a lot of people did. John, of course, has very real and good reasons for hating Wesley, but I'll let him tell you about those if he wants to. 1987, right, is when this started. 87 or 86? 87.
September of 87.
Yeah. So 1987 is when this started. So we've had The Last Starfighter, and before that we've had, obviously, Star Wars, and we've had all the other Star Trek that came before, and we've had Battle Beyond the Stars, and we've had Jason of Star Command, and we've had crappy comedies about space. I think Spaceballs was actually that summer. We've had space at this point. When Star Trek hit in 66, you don't need anybody to stand on the bridge and go, golly, wow, you know, because we haven't seen much like it. I mean, there's been the occasional movie, I suppose. And, you know, I guess I don't know where it was compared to Lost in Space, but Lost in Space blew, and we knew that. Or we know that now anyway. I guess I shouldn't say it that way. We need somebody to stand there and say, golly, wow. And I found, actually, in watching it again today, preparing for this, I was appreciative of the fact that Wesley was there going, gee whiz, you know, and he knows a lot about the stuff. I mean, and, you know, you get a little bit of the precocious youngster off of him. And I love the fact that Picard has no idea how to deal with him. That's kind of cool, too, for both, you know, the fact that he doesn't deal well with kids, plus the whole thing with his dad. But I actually found him a fairly important character, at least in the first episode. Now, you know, when he nearly dies for stepping on the grass or, you know, whatever it is that happens very soon, I may tire of him. But right now, I think he's wonderful. The whole thing with Data as kind of the Vulcan, I mean, it's kind of similar and kind of different. I mean, the whole looking at humanity as something that you don't really get, it's very different than Spock, though, because he actually wants to be human, whereas Spock was just like, you know, oh, man, did I smile? I didn't mean to smile. Right. I gotta do some kind of penance or something, whatever we do around that.
Go light some candles in my quarters and apologize.
Yep. Drink from an incredibly ornate and hard to drink from glass, apparently. Everybody else, I mean, Picard is a really interesting character. He's a very different kind of character. I love the fact that he's like, so you wouldn't let some other captain go down to the planet? Good, because I might try something like that and don't let me. That's a very different kind of executive than Kirk was. And everybody else, I mean, it's just kind of, you know, I haven't gotten much of a feel off of everybody else yet. I like the fact that Worf is sort of this divided character, even in the first episode, when Picard wants to go off and do something, and Worf's like, well, I can't, I'm a Klingon, I can't let my leader go, and Picard's like, no, you're also a Starfleet officer, and you'll follow orders. Oh yeah, I'm that too. I mean, that sets up a lot of, you know, potentially interesting stuff going forward. Nobody offended me, honestly. There was not a character. Getting everybody's background was really fascinating to be reintroduced to these characters that I, you know, have known for years.
I'll back you up there, Ken, about Wesley. His introduction into the show is, maybe not the greatest moment in the world, but his introduction onto the bridge, I think, is really sweet and is really nicely played. And I like the discomfort that everybody has at that moment. It's really, really well done. Of course, Patrick Stewart is, he inhabits that character right from the beginning. Jonathan Frakes inhabits that character right from the beginning. I think he gets better as the show goes on, and I think we'll notice those little changes in his characterization of Riker, not just the beard.
Yeah. Can I pause you for a second, though? I mean, do you think that's the actor getting better, or do you think that's the character maturing?
That's a good question. I think it might be a little bit of both.
I feel like both. I feel like the actors, now Patrick Stewart was great from the start, but for the overall cast, I feel like they really did, after a couple of seasons together, everyone's game was elevated a bit and the actors all get better.
I think there's something about that too, that, you know, when an actor realizes, okay, I've gotten the pilot under my belt, I'm done with that. That was the hard part. Now I'm actually in this for the year. And now I'm actually in this for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. They can start to do a little bit of that reflection on the character that I was talking about with Gene reflecting on his overall creation, where they can kind of settle into it and maybe they're bringing ideas to the directors or the writers or what have you to kind of flesh it out. So I tell you the one, and I hope, you know, people don't take offense at this, but the character that I'm not on board with is Tasha Yar.
Yeah.
I think that it, at least in Farpoint, the characterization, the earnestness, the way that she is directed, boy, does that not work for me at all.
I agree with you on that. I really don't like the idea of Tasha Yar as a character. I think if she were written today, I mean, she's kind of like Starbuck, maybe. Mm-hmm. She would be that type of character. But the way that she's written and presented, like you said, directed as well, the way that Denise Crosby delivers her lines as well in Encounter at Farpoint really doesn't work for me.
Well, and you have to wonder, did she do those scenes one way and the director say, no, 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 I want more, I want this, right, I want this. And then you, as the actor, you go, okay, well, I'll do it. It may suck. And then it's not your choice what version of that ends up in the final cut.
Right, right.
So it's hard to actually lay blame on that. But as soon as those words came out of my mouth, as you said, I was thinking of Starbuck. That's the way that character would be written now.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Would probably be better for it.
Mm-hmm. And would probably be a great character.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And probably not written off quite so soon. Yeah. Yeah, so it was a good idea. I love Marina Sirtis. Now, whether or not Deanna Troi really finds her feet right away, I think they didn't know exactly what to do with her, except just to write lines about, I feel this, I feel that. That becomes a little by rote at a certain point. She's a fabulous woman and a fabulous actress, and you know, I can't wait to see more of her as the show goes along.
Yeah, I actually found it quite interesting how Deanna was treated almost in some ways in Encounter at Farpoint more like the command line officer she will eventually become. You know, Picard is looking to her as this sort of surrogate first officer when Riker's not there yet. And she's saying, you know, technical things about ship operations, like the board shows green and so on. And I thought that was really interesting because it's not something you expect, especially having seen Deanna's journey later on as she tries to take the commander's test in the later seasons and says, you know, I saw Dr. Crusher standing in for the captain and I was excited about that and I wanted to try it. But here she's doing it. And, you know, that's pretty interesting stuff. And I think it's probably the most redeeming thing that Troi gets to do in this episode, because the rest of the time she's either, you know, she's being Riker's long lost love and so on.
I forget, you know, when I was doing the whole rundown of the characters, are we doing Q in this as well? Because he's not a character, but he's a character. And
I think in the story,
what a character
part,
he is.
Yeah, definitely want to talk about Q a bit.
All right.
Real quick, talk about the lost love thing here, though, Michael, this was an interesting point here where they did take the Decker-Ilea bit, especially as it would have been used in Phase 2, and just transfer that over onto Will and Deanna.
Right. Yeah, that was it's funny because if you don't know the story of how Phase 2 became Next Gen, essentially, that's not obvious. But the minute you start to put those pieces together, you're like, oh, wow, yeah, that's just basically copy pasted. Okay.
I just wonder if Delton weddings are performed in the nude.
I would hope
so. Well, let's jump into the story then. So, Ken, you want to talk a bit about Q, and Q really challenges the what I see as more utopian ideals that we see from Roddenberry and TNG. But Q is there to put them on trial and say, you haven't made as much progress as you think that you've made.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'm just thinking it's interesting to see sort of the impish godlike character again, a la Trelane. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one time that we have in the movies, the one time that we have anything like that is in Star Trek V, and he's just a bad guy. I mean, he's not really challenging anybody. He's just, I would be curious to know what his crimes were that got him imprisoned. But I mean, he's like, you know, he's this uber powerful dude who's not quite powerful enough to bend space and time the way a Trelane or Trelane's, you know, sort of energy parents or now Q does. And even though he doesn't talk anything about the Q continuum much, he does say, we call ourselves Q. Which is interesting. Is he talking about, you know, himself, like referring to himself as a royal we, or is there this whole other thing? Right. We don't know yet. But he's a fantastic foil. And, you know, you can probably leave this episode wondering, all right, so is this just a guy who hates humans, or is this a guy who's actually protecting the galaxy or the universe? I mean, what is this guy? Love the outfits, you know, love the voices, love the whole affectation. There's something great about when he shows up in the Starfleet uniform and when, you know, Picard says to him, you know, if you had earned that uniform, you would understand that everything you're saying is wrong. From the second he gets there, if he had ended up being, I don't want to say the bad guy, but if he had ended up being the foil all the way through, you still would have had a really interesting show. I mean, thankfully you did have more than one foil all the way through, but, just kind of awesome. It's great to meet all of these characters again, especially, I don't want to say especially Q, because it's great to meet all of them again, like I said.
Yeah, the thing that I thought of immediately was Trelane.
Yeah.
Again, as well. I mean, he just really smacks of that, and I have to wonder if that was on purpose that they that they went in that direction with this character.
I wonder, too, because you know that Trelane has been retconned as being a Q, Greg Cox did in his novels, and it does make sense. I mean, it's not a perfect comparison, but it does make sense, and I do wonder, like you say, John, if that was the genesis of Q, at least creatively, was to take specifically Trelane. I mean, we do have lots of godlike characters in TOS, but specifically Trelane, and evolve that into this Q character.
It's interesting, though, how with Q we have, just in terms of the characterization, a little bit about how it's written and a little bit about how it's performed by John Delancey, you know, whereas Trelane was this kind of unstable child who had kind of temper tantrums, Q is kind of calculating and sadistic and nefarious consistently and all the time. And while he's having fun the whole time, he's having fun in a very different way than Trelane did. So I didn't mind, you know, the fact that we had once again have another godlike alien coming to fiddle with us, because it was so obvious that, one, he was quite dangerous, but two, it was just so much fun to watch John Delancey have so much fun, especially as he's cycling through all those characters from human history and going from talk about commies to, you know, the narcotic addled enforcers of the 21st century. It was just a ball.
Well, I thought what was cool about that is it made me think about the conversation that Ken and I had in Star Trek VI, because we were talking about whether or not there's a value in seeing the process of overcoming these human problems, the prejudice, the racism, etc., or being in that future that Gene Roddenberry says is the future that we're going to achieve. And to me, all that Q stuff of rehashing history, that was Gene Roddenberry's shorthand for the course of human history and the course of the human future. You know, we made this mistake, we made this mistake, we made this mistake, and there's Picard always with the perfect words at hand to express being the human advocate. So all of those moments really stood out absolutely perfectly as Gene trying to then make a case for what his version of the future looks like and what he thinks humanity should be like. So I think all those scenes have great value in terms of just the overall portrait of Star Trek. I do think that there's something a little weird about Q. Like, Q is very entertaining. Q is a lot of fun. But you do have to wonder, okay, well, why is he interested in humanity? Why the theatrics? Well, yeah, right. And he's bored. Okay. And then we've gotten through what is revealed about Farpoint Station, which in terms of a plot line is a great classic Star Trek plot line.
Right.
But it's sort of this strange buildup with Q sort of looming, like, this is going to be dangerous and you're on trial here. And it's like, well, no, we just need to be nice and figure out what these are and fix this problem. Nobody's going to die in the process, okay? You know, this isn't going to start a war or anything.
Plus, Beverly's going to get some great fabric and clothes for everyone on the ship.
Hold on a second. I mean, the obvious question is humanity going to stick with its, you know, sort of colonial history? Or is it going to understand that this is actually a living thing? I mean, it would be very easy for people to just turn from it, right? It's a perfect situation. It's giving them all the food they need. It's giving them all the resources they need. It's giving them a great place to live. It would be very easy to look the other way on the whole thing. I mean, honestly, if they hadn't had a Beta Z or Beta Zoid, if they hadn't had Deanna there, they would have moved through the whole thing without even realizing. Necessarily, they would have known that something was up, but they might not have figured out that something was actually being hurt by this. So, I mean, it would have been a very easy thing for them to just say, "Wow, we're doing mission log, aren't we?" I apologize. It would have been a very easy thing for them to just turn away, and that's what Q was testing. Playing to every single, like, the worse angels of our nature, I suppose, as opposed to the better, right? Oh, this thing's going to attack you. You better attack back. Oh, you know, why do you care about that thing down there? Because look at all the stuff it's given you. I mean, he's really tempting them to be as bad as they can be because it's easy. and Picard's choosing to do the hard stuff instead.
Didn't Q watch Devil in the Dark?
Do you think Kirk would have handled it differently in TOS? What would he have done in your eyes?
Well, the first thing to figure out is if Q can bleed. Because if Q can bleed... I'm sorry. that's for a novelist. I don't know. I mean, what would Kirk have done? The right thing, because Kirk always does the right thing.
I just mean it in comparison to the ideals of the series, like approaching this issue, Gene approaching this issue in his 60s and versus in his 40s. And of course, he wrote this with DC Fontana, who was heavily involved in TOS as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the two of them. How do you approach the same challenge for mankind?
Wow. That's something we'll have to talk about when we do Encounter at Farpoint, John.
Maybe.
Could you imagine this episode without Q in it? Like, how important is Q to the setup of the tone of TNG and what Encounter at Farpoint does to set the series in motion?
He's important because, I mean, as cool and as advanced as Next Gen is, I mean, both compared to where we live today and compared to the original series, there's still stuff out there that we don't get. There's still stuff out there that we kind of have to worry about. I think he's important because of that. Could they do this episode without Q? Sure. I mean, as long as they had Deanna. Or could they do this episode without Deanna? Sure, as long as they had Q. I mean, you actually need sort of, I don't want to say supernatural, but you need something just sort of above the, you know, the five senses to make this happen. Or the regular mechanics to make this happen in Q's case.
It's a really interesting point because so many people feel like Deanna is useless in TNG, especially at the beginning. But like you're saying that if she weren't there, maybe this whole thing would have played out differently and would not have worked.
Yeah, if she weren't there, it just would have been wacky that, wow, I wanted gold fabric and here's gold fabric. Or, oh, I wanted an apple and yeah, here's an apple.
This would have been like Riker's usual stopping point on shore leave for like the best apple to kick off his vacation. And a very different Star Trek.
Out of curiosity, by apple, do you mean apple or are you making some sort of aspersion about Mr. Riker? Or Commander Riker, I'm sorry.
I'll have to decide on that and get back to you with my answer.
I think... to answer your original question, the story plays out like two different stories already. There's an A plot and a B plot winding their way around each other. And that's fine. You know, that's the way that a lot of good television is written. But you could extract them. You could separate them. And if you just have the incidents at Farpoint Station, then you're replaying Devil in the Dark. If you just have the scenes with Q, then you're kind of sort of replaying Trelane. But to me, that stuff is really there for the Gene Roddenberry soapbox to say, here's who we were, here's how we've changed, here's who we're trying to be. So that all of that has value to go together. Now, I don't know if they would necessarily be very good on their own, because as we say on Mission Log, does the episode hold up? Well, certainly not bad. We all like the characters. We've all established that. But is it really the best of Star Trek? Well, it's the best of Star Trek if we say that the episodes in which we get to save and understand a helpless creature, like we did in Devil in the Dark, are important. So, sure. But it's probably, it's definitely not one of the TNG highlights that people point to and go, wow, that's the best of the Next Generation. Right. We get to wait and get that a few years later.
It's more than about the helpless creature, though. It's more than about helping the helpless creature. It's also about not just taking what we want because we want it.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's always challenging to get, to deliver a coherent storyline. Yeah, in an origin story, in a pilot episode, where you are just saddled with all this exposition and stuff, so much so that like I think somebody must have gotten tired when writing Geordi's dialogue, because like he actually just kind of, you get so frustrated with the doctor. With the doctor's about to tell us about the visor, and he just runs through it in about six sentences in a row, and he's like, "I'm really tired of talking about this." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, how we're getting."
Not everyone got tired of it. Some people appreciate it because we already know that Lady Gaga, she ripped her look off from Shauna in Gamesters of Triskelion. She also ripped off a title of an album and a song from Geordi, because he's sitting there in sickbay and he says to Beverly, I was born this way.
Nice. Yep.
You're right. Very I hadn't good. Considered that.
Well, what are some other story elements that stand out for you guys here in setting up a new series? You know, things that come to mind for me are, of course, the holodeck and how they play up the technology. You're not familiar with these new Galaxy-class starships. And I love when it says, Lieutenant Commander Data, now located. And like he's a comedian or like he's giving a performance. Like he'll be there all week. And then the lights flashing along the corridor to help you. Yeah. You're the first officer of the ship, and yet lights are going to guide you around the ship. There was a lot of this tech. You know, we talk about technology and technobabble in Star Trek, and here it still feels like, how would I describe it? It's, I guess it's because we're still in the 80s and we're this, even this technology still seems futuristic to us then. There's this tendency I felt with what Gene Roddenberry was doing here to just really play up the technological advancement angle a lot and really point it. I mean, they're the, you know, he wanted, of course, to be able to separate the saucer, even in the original series, and couldn't. So now he can separate the saucer. And just this huge, huge sequence of separating the saucer and the manual docking and all of that.
Well, before you get too far away from the from the Google Maps on the Enterprise D thing, I adore right. that because, you know, the some of what Star Trek does is predict the future, and it does that it really poorly sometimes and really accurately in others. And this is a wonderful example of I think an accurate one. Not that we can do precise indoor navigation. Actually, it's much more challenging than doing it outdoors these days. But to see it happening, to see the way the interface is designed with the guiding light cues that by the way, safely escort you from the leering woman who gave you the direction in the first place. But also to see like the map pop up on the panel and guide you directly to the door. You know, that it just immediately recalls for me driving with the assistance of Google Maps or any other turn-by-turn navigation system. And it's just stunning because, you know, had I watched it in its first airing, and even when I did watch it several years later, I was like, wow, now that is, we're never going to get to that point. There's never going to be a computer advanced enough to show us where to go. So there's just a nice detail that I liked. Go ahead, sir.
Well, no, they actually did that in The Cage. I mean, there's a fantastic, they hang just a little too long on the communicator in The Cage. Like, if they were making that today, they would never sit on the communicator for as long as they do when he lays it down on the table. But when he lays that down on the table and we stay on it for like 4 seconds or 5 seconds, yeah. That's Gene Roddenberry going, look, this is going to happen, right? It would have been very easy to say, okay, well, we have this technology where, oh, you want to know where anybody is? Just ask the computer. And then the next scene could be him in the holodeck because he asked the computer and he did it. But we actually get walked through the ship by the computer because this is Gene Roddenberry going, look, right. we're going to do this. I mean, we're going to do all this other stuff too, but we're going to do this. I mean, you're right. We do sort of sometimes get caught up in the technobabble thing, but there are times that he shows us, look at this thing that we're going to be able to do. And it's not dumb. I mean, it's not like the transporter. I'm not saying the transporter is dumb, but the transporter is marvelous, but it's inaccessible. You know, yeah. The communicator is accessible because we had seen walkie talkies at that point, but this is sort of like that, but different. And this whole idea that we're going to have computers one day, they're going to be able to tell us, you know, where people are and how to get places. I mean, that's an insane idea in 87. And yet we all know about computers. Most of us of a certain age had used computers at that point. And they're illustrating, it's not just far future where we're all going to, you know, hold hands and not sing Kumbaya, but hopefully a better song. but then they're also showing us some sort of near future stuff, which is interesting because it's supposed to be 300, 400 years from now, but it's illustrative of where we're headed as well.
I think it's kind of an inspired moment that the first time they go to Red Alert, Picard says, shut that damn noise yeah. off, or whatever the line
right.
is.
Yeah. You know?
Because it's something that everybody has heard, and we realize that, again, this is just, it's just a thing. It's just a technology that happens, and we can't always control it, and we're tired of it, and we can get rid of it. You know, I like that it's not a point and look at this kind yeah. of technology. Ken, I was going to ask you if you thought that the separation of the primary and secondary hull in Farpoint is longer or shorter than the Tribble fight in the bar at K7 space station?
I actually don't feel like that's a fair comparison. I think the fair comparison is, do we take longer to separate and reassemble the 1701D or to look at the 1701 in the motion picture?
Oh,
yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Or the dune buggy sequence in Nemesis.
Oh, yeah, right, is that too. 1701, still a prettier ship.
Picard says a couple of other interesting things here, John. He says, inform all decks, all crew, by printout only, that we're going to do these things. So I'm just picturing what they're going to spit out, I guess, on the screen. I would hope there is no paper coming out of the wall, but it's like, don't make an announcement. Like, do it quietly. Let everyone know.
Yeah.
And then also in explaining technology and how these things work, he actually explains to his crew that has been to Starfleet Academy and stationed on the flagship what maximum acceleration means.
With regard to that printout, did anyone else envision, because there was that, I think it was the cage also in the original series when they on the science console, there was a literal printout on paper. And I was like,
well, I'm picturing a slot on the wall and the old from the 80s, the fan fold.
Oh,
paper,
the printer paper with the guide holes, right?
Holes on the sides that you feed through the dot matrix printer.
Yeah, and like what
I'm
makes
just picturing
it
that spewing out into the corridors all over the ship.
It's like it's in you know the font they use on the consoles, so that's why it's futuristic, right? Like, yeah, it's got like an Okudagram printed on it. I was like, ah, yes.
And like on the floor in the corridors, there's a little basket so that when it comes down, it can fold back up so it's not messy. Yeah.
Well, you know, you kind of wonder then if print is a word then that just means show it on a screen.
That's what I was thinking.
Because
really,
now that you say it, I think about how even in Voyager, you know, they say you got mail.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah.
It's not mail. Yeah. It's a message on a pad.
Well, it's S-mail. It's subspace mail.
Right. Subspace mail. There you go. Yeah. There you go.
Smell.
Yeah.
You got smell.
Well, and you know, the odd things that we'll point out, you know, that they say that something was on tape.
Yeah.
You know, and we know that the thing is not on tape. There's a script note in, was it Court Martial? I think it was Court Martial. There's a script note that said, no, they're not using a tape. They're using something else, whatever the technology is. But then in another episode, the word tape will just kind of slip by. There was an animated, I think it was The Practical Joker, and Bones says something about the tape must have skipped or something like that.
No, it was the Pleasure Planet one, right?
Yeah, what? No, it was Practical Joker. They were in the holodeck.
Oh, that's right.
And
okay.
Walking around in the woods, and McCoy's like, oh, the tape messed up.
Yeah,
really?
That's
a lot of information on a tape. You know?
God, what would be the analog for Next Gen if they had decided to go with such a contemporary like reference, like the holodeck goes wrong and they're like, wow, that damn laser disc is skipping again. Somebody get out there and kick
it. Right. Exactly. Well, it would be, they would be single-sided, and then as they're reading the briefing, they would have to flip it over to read the rest of the briefing.
Yes. Exactly.
Because double-sided laser disc players, they didn't get those on the Enterprise D until the third season.
So they made the treaty with the Romulans. Right.
Right.
That's right. The Treaty of Alderaan said that you cannot have double-sided laser disc players on your starships.
Right.
Ken, anything else you want to point out about Encounter at Farpoint?
Golly. I will say that it actually made me more excited about going into. There's been a lot of razzing from people on online about the fact that, oh, it's very exciting to get to Next Gen. Now all we have to do is get through the first two seasons.
Right.
And I will say that I really surprised myself, and I'm turning out to be just a gigantic softie, apparently. I cried at the end of Star Trek VI, and I cried at the end of the Encounter at Farpoint. Not like bawling my eyes out, but I teared up because this is the beginning. I mean, I've told this story on a couple of different podcasts, but when Rod asked me if I wanted to be part of Mission Log, I immediately flashed back to when Star Trek was still on TV, and my roommate at the time and I would watch this 1 hour thing, and then talk about it for three. You know, so do I want to be part of this? Well, sure. I mean, I've been doing it, you know, for the past 20 years. Why not? These characters are just they're the ones that I grew up with. I mean, and I was older. I mean, I was a senior in high school when this started. But I mean, they're the ones that got me into Star Trek. They're the ones that pulled me into the whole thing. It's just really incredibly exciting. And I think it's probably a lot like, I think people remember it sort of begrudgingly the way they remember all of the odd number Star Trek movies or, you know, things like that. I think there's a lot more here than people are willing to give credit for. And yeah, I know it's going to be uneven. And I know, you know, Wesley is going to be insufferable at some point. But yeah, I'm just incredibly excited to sort of be back with these people in a way.
How about you, Michael? Any final thoughts on Encounter at Farpoint and the beginning of TNG?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot that I kind of took notes on as I was rewatching, and so much that I'm sort of in the same boat, Ken, where I came into it with reduced expectations because I don't rewatch Encounter at Farpoint a lot. I think there is some issues with it that make it really difficult to watch. I think the pacing's just all wrong. This could have been fit into, you know, 70% of the time. There's just some shots that go on forever, and I'm like, okay. But you know, when you come into it with that mentality, it's then commensurately easier to be impressed, or at least it is for me. And little moments that touched me, you know, the McCoy scene, of course. But a little other stuff like Wesley showing up on the bridge and Picard going from super angry at some kid to realization that he's Beverly's son. And then that I knew your father, Wesley, you know, just little bits like that, that really I had some teary moments myself. And it's those that I really treasure from this pilot, which is certainly not my favorite of the pilots, but really, you know, still managed to get a lot done of what they were trying to accomplish. And I think it set the series off on an okay footing that made it possible to grow into what we came to know eventually.
So John, mission log, you guys are up now to TNG. Star Trek VI is out. I don't know if you have any supplementals coming up before Encounter at Farpoint, but when can people expect to hear you guys start in on TNG? And do you have anything special, different, prepared for the show, any segments, anything you're going to do differently than you've done up to this point?
We probably need to talk about the music at some point.
Yeah, right. Ken does a fabulous job of sort of re-theming each section of Mission Log. So there's TOS, there is TAS, the supplementals have their own feel, the movies had their own feel. So we've talked about kind of redesigning that going into TNG. We've talked about redoing some stuff on the website. We will launch our first Next Gen episode on July 31st, 2014. That is the first day of Star Trek Las Vegas. So we actually built in a 1 week hiatus. We wanted to launch it on that date. It just felt right.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
cool.
We launched our first episode of Mission Log at Star Trek Las Vegas 2012. So that seemed like a good way to kind of usher in this new period for us. Other than that, people have asked us if the format of the show will change, like the structure of the show. And really, we haven't changed it that much. We condensed things for the animated shows. But now doing the movies, we're back to the idea of doing the introduction, doing the trivia, doing the story, and then our immediate impressions followed by the really meaty discussion. And we'll continue with that for Next Gen. The only thing that's sort of always in flux is how long we spend on the story recap. Because sometimes it merits a lot, sometimes it doesn't merit that much. So we want to keep it short and snappy, but make sure we get off all the important points.
Luckily, John actually is the one responsible for Encounter at Farpoint. So, yeah. You're welcome, my friend. It occurs to me the way that we've done this, you get all of the odd numbers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
you must
true.
Be very excited.
Hey, but. Yeah, but you know what? I let's see, when we did the motion picture, yeah, I was really actually looking forward to doing the motion picture and glad at how that turned out. And then Star Trek 3, You know, that was a movie that the plot is pretty easy to get through. And I thought our discussion on that, you really kind of, you took a movie that I liked more than I thought I was going to like and made me like it even more than that. So that's kind of the, there you go. That's kind of the magic of doing Mission Log.
Yeah. I think 3 gets a bum rap. I'm looking forward to listening to your y'all's episode of that one. Cause that's, I'm looking forward to hearing that improvement as it happens on the air.
right. Well, it was not an Omega Glory moment. So. Yeah.
Understood. Well, they can't all be.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they can't.
Right. Well,
thank God.
Well, John, so if people want to, you know, keep up with Mission Log, for anyone listening to this who doesn't already listen to your show, I think most of our listeners listen to Mission Log, but for those who don't, where should they go to find it? You guys are on pretty much every platform, I think, like we are. You're on Swell and all sorts of things that people typically don't think of, I know. So where can people go to get the show?
Well, the cool thing is that, you know, the central place is missionlogpodcast.com, and that has all the main information. It has the archive of the shows. It has the discovered documents, which, you know, discovered documents, we take whatever we can get. And as the site changes, I'm hoping to push out more of those. So they may actually be related to specific shows that we're covering, but it's fascinating archival material no matter what. And like I said, there might be some site changes in store that'll help get even more documents out. That will lead you to Twitter and Facebook, where we're on as Mission Log Pod. We also just started carrying our show on TrekMovie.com, and they've been fabulous getting that really seemed like the right timing to launch that with our coverage of the original series movies. So we're really thankful to them for that. And people email us, you know, missionlog@roddenberry.com. And boy, do we get email.
I bet you do.
We get all the email.
And one more quick plug for you, John. You, of course, do another show, DVD Geeks.
Yeah, DVD Geeks has been on a little bit of a hold recently, but DVDGeeks.tv, you know, Mission Log takes up a lot of time, so we're kind of restructuring how DVD Geeks will work going forward. Maybe even change the name. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. But that's DVDGeeks.tv.
All right. Ken, how about you? Where can people find you? And tell us what else you're doing in addition to Mission Log.
For the past 8.5 years, I've done a daily Apple News and news related to Apple News podcast called macOS Ken. So that tends to be how people can find me on Twitter, it's macOS Ken. On Instagram, it's macOS Ken. Online, it's macOSKen.com. And if you're looking for 15 to 20 minutes of Apple News every day, Monday through Friday, and honestly, who isn't? macOSKen.com would be the place to go and find that.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, John and Ken, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you taking time out for the Ready Room and talking TNG with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Anytime, man.
It's great to share the airwaves with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Chris, that was a great time. As I've said, I don't know, roughly 5 times today. I really like those guys, and I was really pleased that you invited me onto the show to share the airwaves with them and you, talking about such a pivotal episode. So what a great time. Next time we got to talk a little bit more about, the consistency of holodeck water and pixels on the back wall and such.
I sense a new podcast coming up, Michael, the Star Trek Technology Podcast.
Oh, that would be a ball.
We don't really have that covered in a dedicated show yet here on the network.
That's a good point, Chris. And, you know, I mean, 17 is not enough, right? I mean, come on.
We need more.
Absolutely.
We know 2 to 4 new shows for you every single day is just not enough Star Trek in your lives.
It's not enough. And I think that the total number of episodes on Trek FM should never deviate from the total number of decks on one of the Enterprises. So we got to get to 21 first, okay? And then we'll move on.
Well, we can always use the Enterprise E from Nemesis, which has an unlimited number of decks.
It's
because
true.
Of the bottomless pit that's at the bottom of the hole.
24, 26, and infinity, as we all know.
Infinity, yes. Yep. There we go. Yeah, it was great having John and Ken on. You know, I've been trying to... John comes on from time to time. I've been trying to organize John and Ken together. The time zones are a huge challenge.
Oh, yeah.
So big thanks to them for working that out and talking about TNG right before they head into it on Mission Log.
Perfect timing.
But of course, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this week on our 17 shows, as you mentioned, Michael. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Roddenberry did not like that sequence at all because he felt that Kirk would not have done that, that wasn't in the Star Trek spirit, that Kirk would have studied the creature, not killed the creature.
Earl Grey.
I love how the Cardassians look, especially once they're firmly established and not wearing what looks to be like cardboard drink holders you get from McDonald's. It looks like that's the material that it's made out of.
The Orb.
To have this many habitable moons surrounding a habitable planet seems very interesting, because usually what you get is a planet that's uninhabitable but is being orbited by a habitable moon.
The Ready Room.
And Worf's like, well, I was at the Marzon colony, and then the audio fades out where the writers are like, we're just not even going to try to explain this.
To the journey!
Just think about it. The Doctor is a priest. That alone is enough to end the episode debate and say that's a fantastic episode.
That's like saying Spirit Folk is worth watching because Harry kisses a cow.
Well, there you go.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Just because he can go away doesn't mean that he can't come back.
To life. Because he dies.
He
Wait,
dies.
Wait, what?
Literally, he like gets his head chopped off. It's kind of brutal. But
we're skipping
spoilers.
Over the part where Molaram pulls his heart out.
Well, yeah, there was that too with the fire.
Yeah.
Warp 5.
I wish selfies were as big of a thing then as they are now, or they were as big in 2003 when this was filmed, because they'd be like, remember that? I have a selfie at the time I turned into an alien. I have a selfie of me with ridges.
Melodic Treks.
Now this changed when he sang in Leonard Bernstein's Mass, and Bernstein himself saw Picard and told him he should pursue being an actor.
Continuing Mission.
The original series has its own particular lore and fandom that is different.
Yeah.
It is different. So it's so unique to be a part of something that is so dedicated to bringing back such a particular and specific part of that Star Trek universe.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find them anywhere you get your podcasts. We're all over the place. Just search for the name of the show you'd like to listen to, or Trek.fm, or the Trek FM Complete Master Feed, which contains every episode of every show that we do in one individual feed right there. In fact, some people pointed out recently that they really love that feed because that's how they first learned about the new Axanar official podcast, because that episode was in the Master Feed about a day before the official dedicated feed was launched.
That's some underground marketing you're doing there. Don't act like that was no accident.
Oops, how did that get in there? I have no idea.
I don't know.
So if you're in iTunes or on Stitcher, be sure to review our shows. As I mentioned in news briefly, we have a reviews promotion going on right now. We love to hear from you, of course, and know what you think about the shows, but reviews are also important to us because they affect how we rank in iTunes and on Stitcher, and how easy it is for other Star Trek fans to find our shows. We know that you're probably listening to podcasts when you're out doing something else. You're not near a computer. It's not convenient to leave a review at that time. So we want to give you some added incentive to do that. So we're giving away some great prizes, including a season of Star Trek on Blu-ray or DVD of your choice, some Star Trek novels of your choice, a complete set of our original alien artwork badges that we have, also official Starships Collection ships, from Japan, as I mentioned in the feature, and those have the magazine in Japanese, which is a pretty cool collectible for all of you guys outside of Japan. It's very easy to enter. All you need to do is to review our shows on iTunes and or Stitcher. Each review you leave will get you an entry in the drawing. You can review the same show on both. So for example, review The Ready Room on iTunes, review The Ready Room on Stitcher. That counts as two entries, and you can review the master feed. That counts as a third, and you can review all the shows that you listen to on the network. After you leave your reviews, you need to go to trek.fm/review and fill out the form that you find there. That lets us match up your real name to the reviews that you left, and you know you have different screen names on iTunes or Stitcher. Also, which shows you reviewed, where you left the reviews. We've gotten a lot of reviews recently, Michael. We shared some of them last week.
Oh, good.
First, there's one from 17 Brian, and that's Brian with a Y, just like my middle name.
Hey.
He left us a 5-star review. He said, nice overview. The Ready Room provides a nice view into various happenings in the Star Trek realm. The guest stars are a good addition. So he's a fan of yours, Michael.
I'm just a guest host. I ain't no star.
Also, Phasers to Wellsby left us a 5-star review. If you only listen to one Star Trek podcast, is the title. And he says, from their coverage of news and current events in the Star Trek world to their extended discussion of topics and episodes, this podcast really provides everything you need as a Star Trek fan. If you only have time to listen to one Star Trek podcast, this is it. They spend time with all the series, so you can get a little bit of everything over the course of a few episodes. So I really appreciate that. I will say, make time for two at least, The Ready Room and Mission Log. Listen to those two.
Good advice.
Then if you have time for all of our dedicated specialty shows, tune into those as well, where we really dig deeply into all the series and all the topics.
Good advice.
So those are two recent reviews. I'll share some more next week. So we're looking forward to hearing from you. Again, remember iTunes and Stitcher both, also the master feed, great ways to get your entries into the drawing. We're doing this through July 31st, so all entries received by midnight July 31st Pacific time will be in the drawing, and we look forward to hearing from you. Now, if you would like to share your thoughts on today's show, we would love to hear from you there. There are a number of ways you can do that. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. We're all over the place in social media. On Twitter, our username is TrekFM, Facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a community on G+. We also have forums at Trek.fm/forums, and you can send me a voicemail through the website. Look for that in the left sidebar. Now, Michael, when you're not searching Groppler Zorn's office for some apples, where can people find you?
Well, first of all, let me say that that search does not take very long, and I appreciate that. People can find me when I'm not there on Twitter, where I reside at Captain Two Phones. It's Captain the number 2 Phones, where I tweet about 10% of the time about Star Trek and about 90% of the time about smartphones. And I also host a podcast of my own talking about the latter. So if you're into mobile technology to an extreme degree, I can be heard every week on the Pocket Now Weekly Podcast at pocketnow.com.
Very dramatic URL there, Michael. I like that.
Thank you. Thank you. It's very important.
That's your stage training coming through, isn't it?
Absolutely. Just a little bit of vocal fry after a late night yelling over music in dive bars. Very important vocal training is had in those places.
Great. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/cbrianjones. Feel free to hit me up there. And I have my own website, cbrianjones.com. And then I do a lot of shows on the network. There's The Orb, Continuing Mission, Literary Treks, Matter Stream, Hyperchannel, our daily news show, Warp 5, and also I co-host the new official Star Trek Axanar podcast with Alec Peters. So check that out as well. I'm all over the place if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. Before we let you go, I'd like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks online. Go pick up New Frontier, books 1-4, absolutely free, or anything else that you'd like. It's audibletrial.com/trekfm. That's the URL. Sign up for the trial. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep that audiobook, so there's nothing to lose, but I know you're going to want to stick with them. And when you try Audible, it really does help us keep the Ready Room coming to you every single week. So support us by trying out Audible. You'll get great audiobooks in the process. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network as well. Well, Michael, I'm going to beam back down to Farpoint Station and find out if there's any of that fabric left. I know that Beverly told him to send it all up to the ship, but usually they have some extra stock in the back if they're good merchants anyway. So I'm going to go check that out.
Yeah, I'm sure that, some mystical force whipped it into existence in the vault where it came from. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Chris, I think it's time to stick a star drive section in it manually, because the ready room is done.